That was Chris Perkis talking to J.P. Devlin. We're with David Cassidy. David, I know you work with the Alzheimer's Research and Prevention Foundation in the United States.
Yes.
And Anton, that your mother suffers from Alzheimer's.
Oh, yes. That story that you just heard about losing your husband or losing your wife or losing your child or mostly, I'll tell you what, my mother's had she's had dementia for well over 7 years, probably a decade, and I haven't lived in the same city as her, although I would call, her husband would take the phone calls most of the time and make excuses the last year or so, and I would speak with her. Hi, Mom, how are you? Oh, busy, busy, busy. I'm running. I've got to go to my dance classes. So I'm assuming everything is okay.
Yeah.
I'm on the road. I live 2,000 miles away in Florida. Anyway, I got a phone call in the middle of the night about 8 years ago, and I was on the road at the time. I was working, and it was the Sherman Oaks, which is in the valley in Los Angeles, very near where my mom lived and where I spent a lot of time. It was the Alzheimer's, the senior Alzheimer's-related floor, and asked if I was, in fact, David Cassidy, the son of Evelyn Ward. Yes, what? Your mother was found lost, screaming in her nightgown at 2 o'clock in the morning and couldn't find her home. Mm. Now, my mom, I'm her only son. I had taken care of her really since I became a professional and could afford it. She's either lived with me or I had supported her all those years. And I had a very unique mother. She was very independent. She was very stubborn. But it was very much alive. And I immediately after getting that phone call, I heard her voice in the background, and I could tell something was different. Her husband had died about a month before, and he was a wonderful guy. They had a platonic relationship, but finally I convinced my mother to marry him. And she was objecting to it the whole time. I said, Mom, you're 80 years old. It doesn't matter. We don't ever touch each other. We don't do that. I said, Mom, you're doing it for the right reasons. So I flew out. I went and looked at various places where my mother could live, various senior living, assisted living, and then I got more serious about it, and I will tell you more about it in detail because it changed my life dramatically, and I'm working with the Alzheimer's Foundation of America.
Yeah. Hold the thought, David, because there's lots of people I know who'll want to tweet.
I would love
subject.
To talk.
We've always had somebody tweeting about ADD, as you mentioned earlier. That's right.
Yeah.
Hatton,
well,
in Essex.
It's a problem in itself, but this is going to be an epidemic, and I'm going to do something, okay. Hopefully, to change the world.
Well, do get in touch with the program if you've shared those experiences.
Yes, indeed. Please do.
This is Saturday Live with Richard Coles and Sian Williams. So it's just after 9:30. Let's tell you what's still to come on the programme. A Russian revolution for a British woman who took a degree in her 60s and is now one of the world's leading translators of Pushkin. And surprise, surprise, Cilla Black gives us her inheritance tracks later. Also this morning, John McCarthy is jumping on the metro in Paris.
I'm sitting in a cafe overlooking the opera right in the heart of Paris, having just come out of the opera metro station. And I'm joined by Gregor Dallas, a historian who's written Metro Stop Paris, which looks at the history of the city, I suppose, tied to various metro locations. Gregor, tell us about this magnificent building.
Well, it is indeed magnificent. One of the fans of the opera house was, of course, Adolf Hitler. He wanted everything to look like the Palais Garnier, as this is actually called. A lot of people like Emile Zola detested it.
Really?
I mean, it is quite a gaudy place. This said, it is, I think, the most impressive crossroads in the whole of Paris.
And what musicians were associated with the area around the Opera Metro?
Well, all the great ones, especially Debussy. He spent his life around here. In particular, he had a mistress who lived and worked on this street that we're overlooking here. Debussy changed modern music with his own opera, Pelléas et Mélisande, which was a new kind of music. When it was first heard, it was hated. but the revolution occurred at that time with the performance of Pelléas et Mélisande at the Opéra Comique in 1902.
More from John later. Now, all through the programme, you've been sharing your stories of writing to someone famous and getting a more than encouraging reply. You remember Steve Blacknell moving in with his heroes, the String Band. Later on, we're hearing what happened when one listener contacted Kenneth Williams, who we've been getting emails and tweets to from you this morning.
Oh, well, I've got tweets. Got nothing to do with that, but I do like it.
Okay.
This is from Jenny, and she's tweeted, and it's for you, David. She said, "Are you mates with Donny Osmond?" Because you were, of course, the two great teen heartthrobs. You were the sort of Beatles and Rolling Stones of teen boy heartthrobs.
I wouldn't call us friends, but I would call us definitely as pals. I had dinner with him a few years ago. I got to know his brothers very well, and I mean, Jimmy and Merrill—they're great guys. And I grew up with them as little kids in suits on the Andy Williams show.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Donnie must have been 7, 8 years old. He's a few years younger than I am, but really talented. And you know, we've had so many parallels in our career. The difference was, being 4, 5, 6 years. I don't know how much older I am than he is, but I was living in Southern California and was very much part of the social, political ideology of the 60s and the movement to, honestly, social injustice and individuality and human rights. And I come from a very liberal, we call it liberal, I don't know what you would call it, but it's definitely left of center. And particularly, not necessarily financially or fiscally, but socially, about human beings being treated like human beings and everyone being treated with respect. Mm. And I have great respect for Donnie and for the Osmonds. I think a lot of the fans that were kids tended to be, well, you're either a David fan or you're an Osmond fan.
There's loads coming in. I have to stop you there, David. There's loads coming in. We'll try and do a sort of summary of the points of contact between
you're
going
to have to stop
Cassidy.
Me a lot because I tend to just go on and on.
Okay, we'll wave.
I'm no good at sound bites.
Oh, dear. Thank you very much for all your text. And we were asking, weren't we, for whether you've ever written to somebody famous and got an encouraging reply. And we're going to hear about a listener who contacted Kenneth Williams and became a pen pal of his a little later, Joe Firth, says, "Over the years, I've written to many actors and had replies, ongoing from Nigel Hawthorne before he died, and over the years, Alan Bennett and James Fleet." So get in touch with us this morning. You can text us 84844, email saturdaylive@bbc.co.uk, or you can tweet us at BBC Radio 4, hashtag Saturday Live. Now, as you probably know, it's a bank holiday weekend. If the rain holds off, you might think about heading to the coast, along, of course, with thousands of other people, some of whom will be taking to the A roads in their caravans. Sales have surged this year. It's perhaps not surprising the caravan has many celebrity fans. Richard's one of them, although it's not strictly
It's caravan. Not anything like a caravan.
It's a camper
what is a
van.
Caravan?
Thank you
here?
For the correction.
What is
what
the
you
definition?
Call a camper.
Yes.
Oh, a camper.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like a Winnebago,
a
but
would
much,
be completely
much
different
smaller.
One in the United States. It's so interesting, the language so different.
Well, let me tell you about a Hollywood star who loves his caravans. It's Patrick Duffy, Bobby Ewing from Dallas. Yes. And J.P.
Yeah.
Devlin bumped into him at a caravanning fair where he was checking out the wheels.
I've always been a fan of not just the caravanning, which we don't call it caravanning in the States, you know.
What do you call it over there?
We call it camping, but a lot of people camp with these palatial, giant behemoths. That's really not what I prefer to do. I'm a less is more kind of person, and I like to downsize things. And this caravanning structure in the UK and in Europe in general is really attractive to me right now in terms of condensing your lifestyle into the smallest possible space and still be comfortable.
Am I right in thinking you live on a ranch normally?
Yes.
So why is it you feel the need to downsize occasionally?
I think it's probably because I'm on the ranch. In other words, we have 600 acres of outdoors, and that's where you want to spend your time. You don't need a lot of indoor space anymore. You need a place to cook your meals, to get out of the weather, and to be comfortable. And the whole idea of caravanning is to get outdoors. People should get outdoors more. They should just look at a patch of dirt somewhere, and they would find so much to enjoy. We become very isolated when we're watching television, thinking we're learning about the world, and we're actually not learning anything. This is what the world needs more of.
But when we're watching television, we're normally watching you.
Well, that's the only time I want people to be indoors and isolated, is watching me.
We have a look inside this particular caravan that you've chosen here.
Okay, yeah, let's come on inside. I'll take you on a tour. This has, essentially, if you look at this, it has a kitchen, a bathroom, a bedroom, and a living room. But what they do is they perform all the functions together.
But this is almost as nice as my flat.
Well, then you need to get a raise from your bosses because you need to upgrade just a tiny bit. But it is, isn't it? It's very, very nice. But that's what I think is very attractive, is in such a small space to have all the comforts of home. I mean, here, you know, you have your basic sink, but everything is covered up and can be something else. Your stove has a top on it, so it's a workplace, and then you lift up the glass and then you can cook on it. Doors slide closed so that there is separation between the two. You have to be very careful to know which door is your closet and which door is your bathroom.
So which one's which? I wouldn't know here.
The only way you know is to open it up. If it's got a loo in it, that's where you go to the bathroom.
Well, what if you're in there in the shower, maybe?
Well, and that's the other thing. I'll have to take a look at this one. No, this one has a separate shower and a separate toilet. A lot of them have the shower is all one piece with the toilet. It's really quite remarkable to see.
Tell me a little bit about how you first got into caravans, Patrick. Was it the days of filming Dallas when you had to live in a motorhome?
Well, all actors basically have a second home on wheels. And that's where you live when you're not shooting. And so for 30 years, I've had a little home away from home. It's very ingrained in me to feel comfortable in these spaces.
Well, listen, when you were filming Dallas, did you guys share your caravans at all?
Well, in the very beginning, in 1978, Larry Hagman had a converted bread truck. And being the hippie he was, he did nothing inside except hang hammocks, fabrics on the wall, and had coolers everywhere full of champagne. And the whole cast would go to Larry's, and I think it cemented our relationships for the rest of our lives.
So do you think that friendship was, in many ways, forged in a caravan?
Well, I think it was tested in a caravan. And I know for myself and Larry, the minute we met, Larry and I became instant best friends. There's a reason for that. I have no idea what it is, but there's something there. Caravan, oh, my soul is on the run over land. I am flying, caravan. Tiny little ovens.
Tiny little oven. Would you cook in your caravan?
You would not cook your Christmas dinner here, but I cook all the time. And cooking in a small caravan becomes very inventive. So a kitchen this size, which is literally 4 feet by 4 feet, you can cook the most remarkable meals if you're a good cook. If you're a bad cook, it doesn't matter how big your kitchen is.
Beans on toast.
Yeah, beans on toast.
One could come up with all sorts of interesting psychological theories about why you like living in a little small place like this. Now, have you ever thought of that?
Yeah, I think actually Dumas made me the Count of Monte Cristo in my past life, and I was simply happy in a cell in the dark. I am happy with less is more. I've always have been. We've had a couple of very large homes due to just my great fortune in being a working actor, but I find that I live in probably 3 rooms in them.
And you need to downsize to a bungalow, maybe?
I do. I can live in a bungalow. Caravan.
Careful, that's not the bathroom door, by the way.
Yeah, well, that's probably why half of my clothes are always a bit damp.
JP Devlin with Patrick Duffy, who, of course, has always liked a shower. Remember when he reappeared as Bobby and it was all a dream. Very nice thoughts on caravanning there. Let us know yours.
If only Pushkin had had the same idea. Now, you might think that one of the English-speaking world's leading translators of Russian literature would have been fluent in the language while she could still be dandled on her babushka's knee. But this is not so in the case of Mary Hobson, the classic late developer. She only went to university when she was in her 60s, having looked after her chronically ill husband and brought up their children. In her 50s, she came across Tolstoy's magnificent novel War and Peace, its battles, its balls, its endless theory of history, which just screamed out to be read in the original Russian. So off Mary went to get to grips with the language and culture, winning the Pushkin Prize for translation and eventually her PhD at the age of 74. A recording of her translation of Pushkin's verse novel Evgeny Onyegin is out now, and Mary Hobson is with us. Pozdravlyayu.
Здравствуйте.
Why War and Peace, Mary?
Why War and Peace? Well, I was 56 and I needed a minor operation. I was in hospital. I had to stay in bed for 2 weeks, not get out. And one of my daughters brought me a big fat paperback, English paperback. She said, "Here you are, Mum, you never get a better chance to read War and Peace." And I hadn't read any Russian literature at all. And because I was there trapped in bed, you know, I read all day. There was nothing else to do.
I mean, it's the most wonderful introduction to Russian literature. I think it's the greatest novel ever.
I think so. Yeah. Absolutely, I agree. It's a wonderful novel, even with all the historical things.
Well, yes, I'm not so keen on that bit.
Well, I mean, he's a cunning old fox. First he shows us, then he tells us. Only comes at the end when he's already shown this theory in action.
I mean, it's a daunting enough wodge of literature in translation. I mean, the difference, Mary, is of course it inspired you to want to read it in Russian.
I thought, I have got to read it. I thought for 3 days after I finished, I felt all my friends had emigrated. I just felt, what's happening now? Where are they all? And then, you know, I woke up one night, you know, in this hospital still, and thought, I haven't read it at all. I've just read a translation.
Yeah.
I'm excluded from this thing and I'm never going to be able to read it. And I thought, I have to learn Russian.
Would it have been different if perhaps you'd been given Don Quixote or something? Was there something about it being a Russian novel that particularly
No, honestly, I had no special affinity or interest in Russian at all. I never read any Russian literature and I just... Well, I wasn't much time for reading. You know, when my husband and the four children and everything, you know, we were all together.
So how did you set about actually acquiring the rudiments of the language?
Well, I went and signed up for, at Goldsmiths for an evening class. And then I happened to mention this to an elderly lady. Elderly, she was 9 years older than me. And she's now dead, unfortunately, but she was a lovely woman.
You describe her as elderly.
I was only 56.
Yes, that's not
elderly. And I said, "Guess what I'm going to do?" And she said, "Oh, don't do that. I'll teach you." And she turned out to be a Russian immigre, first wave, you know. She'd come over the Finnish Gulf at 4 in a boat, quarrelling furiously because the grandmother's fur coat had been dropped overboard accidentally. And she lived in Paris, like they all did, singing round the flag and waiting to go back when all this nasty business was over. And finally gave up on that and went to England at 18. So her English was perfect. I had no idea she was Russian. It was the most wonderfully fortunate sort of chance for me.
It's one thing to learn the rudiments at the knee of a white Russian, I suppose, an emigre in London, but of course to really get to grips with the language you have to go to the place it's spoken, and that was true for you.
Well, yes, I did eventually, because after 6 years of sort of fitting it in, rather, life was happening at quite a pace. I was finally on my own, and I thought, all right, now I'll have my life.
Yes.
And
most people become church wardens or join the PCC, but you went to live in...
Well, I did a bit of woodwork and Hungarian needlepoint, and then I thought, oh, blow this, you know. And so I phoned up CEES, the School of Slavonic and East European Studies at London University, and I said, you know, do you take mature students? They said, yes. 62? Yes. Oh, fine, well, I want to join. So I... By this time, I had read War and Peace in Russian. I had read it. It took me 2 years. Yeah. And I read every line very slowly with a dictionary, like a poem I read it, every sentence.
Like Jane on the phone to her Berber, soon-to-be husband.
Absolutely. Dictionary in hand. Yes, absolutely. And I was... so I had already... I'd gone ahead with reading. I hardly spoke a word because my Russian emigre said, oh, no, no, we have interesting conversations in English. I really don't want to talk about it. So that was no good.
But then, and is it, at 64, you found yourself...
Oh, 64.
Well, you found yourself living in Russia at the height of the sort of fallout of perestroika.
It was a time to go there.
Attempted coups against Gorbachev, the rise of Yeltsin. I mean, you couldn't have been in Russia at a more turbulent time.
It was such fun. It was a golden time. It was, honestly, I had such fun. I went off with 20 young students from all over the country and me, and I was 64, and lived in a student hostel. The Russians, for all their savagery, were absolutely prudish, and they said, oh, she can't possibly, you know, share a room with all these young people. So they put me with a young Russian woman. I shared a tiny cupboard-sized bedroom with a Russian woman who was such fun. She's my friend still. She's in Irkutsk, and she'd just come to do a course there. But she was teaching at Irkutsk.
And I've been to Irkutsk. I had a similar experience. I arrived in Moscow the day the coup against Gorbachev collapsed, and I saw the statue of Jasinski come down outside the Lubyanka.
Oh, I am so envious.
But what I didn't realise, and this is a very Tolstoyan point perhaps, is that, you know, these great epochal moments in history happen, but really you're just walking down the road and looking for ice cream.
Well,
and
yes, or food, you know, because we were catering for ourselves, and it was quite hard. You know, I found a wonderful market. Oh, it's a Polozhavska market where you could... where I could find dried apricots and eggs and, you know, this was a find. I bought cabbages from old ladies in underpasses, you know.
Mm. It was an extraordinary time because I was there too in 1991. So we're all there in 1991. And there was a lack of food, and yet there was, as capitalism was coming in, there were extraordinary contrasts. And one of the big supermarkets on Red Square had a showroom in the middle of the supermarket showing BMWs and Mercedes. And in GUM, yes. And yet there was no food to be had. What kind of spirit was there in Moscow at the time?
Oh, it was so extraordinary. We had a lovely, lovely lecturer who was very honest, and because we were studying there, you know, in the linguistic university, and he said, people will tell you that they never really believed in all this, you know, this communism and so on. You know, they just kind of were going along with it, but they're lying. We did, you know.
Mary, when did you get the confidence, if that's the right word, you don't strike me as someone lacking confidence, but when did you get the confidence to decide that you were going to professionally produce a translation of a writer like Pushkin, who is so irreducibly Russian and such a kind of...
I tell you what, confidence is a myth. Yeah. I don't think anybody has it. I just think you think, oh, the hell with it, I'll do it anyway. You know, I'll just be terrified and I'll do it.
Yeah.
I walked round Russell Square, I can't tell you, several times before I dared go into the university on that first day. And I thought, oh, my God, I've made a terrible mistake, because I thought I'm not going to be able to remember all this stuff.
Yeah. And, Mary, I mean, you're now so at home, if that's the word to say, in Russian, that you write in Russian too. You wrote a set of poems in Russian and English about your son who was killed in the motorcycle accident.
No, those were translations. I only write in English.
I beg your pardon.
Those were translations.
You didn't translate?
I write poems as well.
Right,
and these were translated by a Russian.
These were my poems, and they were translated by a Russian.
After you became a translator?
Yes.
That's kind of fascinating.
Well, the thing is...
You let somebody else translate
I tell you
them.
What, 13 years ago, my son died, and a year after that, I was in a train, and on the back of an envelope, and started to write my own poems. I think, of course, having... read so much Pushkin.
Well, that's part of the wonders of Pushkin. Mary Hobson, thank you very much for being with us this morning.
Fascinating.
I'm not sure Luke Wright has ever gone a bundle on iambic tetrameters, duelling and sending his troika skidding across the frozen Neva, but I would put none of these past him, especially not on a bank holiday weekend. He sent us from the park this.